Inside the Friendly Confines with Jesse Rogers, presented by Arlington Toyota. Looking for a smart play on your next vehicle? Arlington Toyota delivers with a full lineup of dependable cars, SUVs, and trucks ready for Chicago drivers. The same trusted team you've known for years is now backed by new ownership from the Andy Moore Auto Group, bringing even more value every day. Visit ToyotaArlington.com today.
Welcome to Inside the Friendly Confines with Jesse Rogers, a Cubs-centric podcast brought to you by Good Karma Brands, ESPN 1000, and our friends at Arlington Toyota. The Cubs continue their series in Baltimore, and we are fortunate enough to be joined on this podcast today by the manager of the Chicago Cubs, Craig Counsell. He'll be with me shortly, so that will take up the entirety of the podcast. We'll get back to our usual segments next week, but this is just week five, and we're presenting you with the manager of the Cubs. Very excited to talk to him. So let's get right to it. Let's go inside the clubhouse with Craig Counsell. All right, let's go inside the clubhouse, specifically up to Baltimore, where manager Craig Counsell joins me. I'm so honored to have you, Craig, in the middle of the season. You guys are so busy. Thanks for joining me. I really appreciate it.
You got it, Jesse.
All right. Tell me about what a manager does on the road before a night game. What's your day like? Because we could talk all day about the game last night or whatever the case may be, but I think people would love to pull the curtain back. Just what's your day like before a night game?
Yeah, I mean, it's a little bit – it's pretty normal. Got up, worked out, looked at some stuff around the league, some players around the league, et cetera. Little work on tonight's game, thinking about some things, a podcast with Jesse Rogers, and then time to go to work.
Sounds good to me. Tell me about how you make out your batting order. I once did a story with Joe Maddon, and it was basically middle of the day. He gets a coffee, opens up his email. He gets a bunch of emails from the front office, the analytical group, and then he would, you know, take their advice, so to speak, and write out his batting order. Are you doing it the night before? Is that a similar way and process that you do it?
Yeah, I mean, you probably start, you know, honestly, you start like maybe for a series in Baltimore, you start on the weekend and sit with when we're at home against St. Louis. So you start kind of mapping out some days as what it's going to look like. You know, this group, we have a pretty regular group in terms of like, you know, Dansby, Nico, Bregman, Pete, like, you know, they're going to play every day, right? Michael Busch. So there's not too much in that, but I think when it comes to the catchers, when it comes to somebody like Sale, who we're trying to, you know, maybe get off his feet once in a while, you kind of plan ahead. And that probably starts the series before. So a lot of times when we're playing the Cardinals this past weekend, we kind of have mapped out lineups for the Orioles already this week.
Yeah, it'd be different if you had a bunch of platoon players, right? That would take more time, and you probably look at deeper analytical things in terms of who to play when and that stuff. You've probably done that before with other teams, whether it be Chicago or Milwaukee, I would assume.
Yeah, I think, you know, the pitching matchups are kind of drive this whole thing. Sometimes pitching matchups change, so that changes things. But we're going based on what the other team is projecting as their starters. And that drives this whole thing. And then, you know, I think healthier players is the other thing you're always looking at. Like I said, we're fortunate. I mean, this is a group, you know, when you're talking about like Dansby and Nico and Pete and Michael Busch, like they're out there every single day. And that's a great trait. It's not easy to get players like that. It's not easy to answer the bell every day as much as those guys have. So we're fortunate from that perspective. You know, it makes my job easier for sure.
Well, that's for sure. But then, of course, you have to spend a lot of time on the pitching staff because of all these injuries. It's incredible. If a fan wants to look at the glass being half full, you're, you know, 10 or whatever games over 500 with all these injuries, and hopefully, cross your fingers, the walking wounded start to come back, as we've seen, hopefully, with Jameson Taillon and some others. So what's that been like? And I'll give you a stat. 10 different players have already earned a save. The record is 12, which you set last year. Record franchise record is 12. We're not even at the All-Star break. You've had 10 different players record a save. Now, that's out of context, of course, but I think that kind of speaks to her, to the amount of injuries that have piled up. What's that been like for you, getting to know new guys and getting to know how to use them?
Yeah, I mean, I think we haven't had stability in the bullpen that much. And I am really proud of how the players have responded to it as much as anything. It's caused some, like players, relievers love to know when the phone's going to ring, like that it's for them. They right. like that. And I yeah. think that's they should want to know. We've been forced in a situation where, like, they're not going to know necessarily who, when the phone rings, who's it's ringing for. And they've done a great job of, you know, responding to that and not making that an excuse and performing despite that. And so, you know, that's the best part of it. And I think of somebody like Jacob Webb, mostly, who's been the kind of the anchor down there and the guy that's been healthy all year and stable down there. He's served a number of different roles, from starting the season pitching, you know, maybe in the fifth or sixth inning in a game that we're not winning, to pitching the back two innings to get a save. And he's done a heck of a job, and he's really been the anchor to this thing with things changing all around him. I'm really proud of what Jacob's done this year. And then for the other guys, it's just try to, as best you can, like, get them into situations that they can have success. And that's, you know, have them available when they're available and when can they have success, and just trying to map that out every day. The game really does it. It's hard to do it before the game. You have to just play the game, and it happens during the game. You know, I think that's what bullpen usage is about. It happens during the game. I could sit here right now and look at a million things. The game's going to change it all. And so that all happens during the game. And we've done it. Our guys have really executed in some big spots.
What about the work between 3 and 7 p.m., if that's when the game starts, in terms of conversations with, let's say, relievers that are up and down? Is that a daily thing with you, or you let Tommy handle it? How are those conversations different than Nico or Dansby, who's been around for yeah. a while? What's that like for you?
Well, I mean, a lot of it is just, it's not necessarily, you know, who's available is important. But I think it's confidence checks. It's giving guys confidence. It's mentioning some things you can do better. You know, it's coaching, it's working on things. And so, you know, some of it goes through Tommy, and some of it is just a direct conversation that is important to have with your players. And yeah, that's really what the pregame time is about to me, is kind of those conversations, those check-ins. And sometimes it's really simple, and sometimes it's a little deeper.
Speaking of that, and I know it could be apples and oranges, but I've often said I think the work of a manager between 3 and 7 is almost as important as what he does from 7 to 10. Obviously, when to pull the starting pitcher is a huge decision. There's other moments, pinch hitter, reliever decisions. But is there some truth to that? Those moments that nobody sees, other than the 45 minutes the media is in there, and we don't even see the conversations, obviously, you're having with players. How much importance is what happens pregame with a manager and his players?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, the kind of the mood of a team or the culture of a team is maybe set in two times. It's during the game, and then it's, you know, the 20 hours that the game's not going on. And it's, I think, from, like you said, 2 to 7, that's when – you know, you're there together the half an hour after the game, that everybody's there together. Those are times when you're just interacting with each other, and that's the behavior of the group. And that a lot of times determines the culture of the group. Culture really is how you interact together as a group. And so that's, you know, the manager's job is part of manager's job is to lead that. It's everybody's job, really. But I think the manager, you know, you pay attention to it as the manager for sure.
92 wins last year. You're pretty much on the same pace, Craig, but it's been done a very different way. I'm curious if anything surprises you in this game, because I think even myself, who's covered it for a long time, is kind of surprised at the streakiness of a player or even a team. But I should know better, because baseball is that sort of inexact sport where it can go south and then get better quickly and back and forth. I always say a team can have three seasons within one, and that might be a low estimate. It might be five or six. You can look so different. Has this been strange for you to end up on the same pace as last year, but in such a different manner?
I mean, the way you said it is right. We act surprised by it, but then we know that, you know, we kind of expect it to happen. I think, you know, what you always have to do is it just reminds you that you can't get too up or you can't get too down when things are going on. And it's just a good reminder for it, really. Now, part of the fun about being a fan is to ride the wave of the emotion and the frustration and the elation of streaks and things like that. But I think when you're in it every day, you know, both the good streaks and the bad streaks riding that wave, you know, I'm not sure how much good it really does you. Right. It's really better to understand that you got to come back and do it again the next day. And you're probably not as good as you are during a winning streak, and you're not as bad as you are during a losing streak. That's an old adage, but it's really, really true. And you have to remind yourself of that really every day in this job, when results just fly at you in this game. I mean, 162 games is what makes our sport unique among professional sports. And that number of results, it just requires you to kind of stay on this even keel, in my opinion.
Yeah, and that applies to the team and individual players. That's what's fascinating about it. I mean, Dansby Swanson is a great example. Such a good attitude. I remember talking with him in San Francisco, and he's just like, I'm just waiting for the dam to break, just waiting for the dam to break. Now, of course, it's not going to break on its own. You have to put in the work. And I'm sort of fascinated by how much, you know, work he's put in, and just more lately, I guess, with John Mailey, and finally results are coming. But like I said, they don't just come automatically. You do have to investigate what's going on. But the key is what you said, I think. You just can't get too down on yourself, because you may never recover. Does that sound right? You play the game. You know it as much as any player today.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Dansby's season has been fascinating, kind of a fascinating mental skills study, really, yeah, about how a player, really handles success and failure. And I do think the one thing Dansby did a phenomenal job of is that, you know, he would admit to you that he was lost for a period. But he was never down on himself, right? There's a difference there. And that difference is like, you can be lost, which means like, I got to find something. And that work is like in a quest to find something, but I haven't lost myself. I haven't lost confidence in myself. I've lost maybe the ability to hit right now, but I haven't lost the ability to find out a way to get back to being the player I am. And I give Dansby a lot of credit there, a lot of credit, because it's not easy. And the failure that you experience is hard to kind of sit with. And he had to sit with it for a while. But he's done a tremendous job of, I think, keeping himself in a good mental space so that you can find the solution, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. You know, I could talk all day with you about every single player on this team and the ins and outs, but I want to talk about at least one more individual, and that's PCA. And I just love everything about what's gone on, because this wasn't contract motivated. This wasn't stardom motivated. They already made an all-star team. Like, I think and taking walks is not sexy. You know, I just think that he wanted to be better for his team and yes, for himself as well. And he, again, put in the work. And, you know, you were around Christian Yelich the MVP year. He's having an MVP caliber year. Obviously, Shohei is a favorite because of what he does. But, like, can you conceptualize what PCA did even after earning the contract? And the biggest thing was, hey, take some more walks, which, of course, wasn't the exact like instruction, but that's really what ends up happening when you have better at bats.
Yeah. I mean, I think, well, Pete's, you know, he's still a really young player. And I think so, you know, as we entered this season, he was, you know, just under probably 2 years of kind of going at this thing. And I think it just shows you that there's still a lot to learn. So he's, you know, 1,000 plate appearances in, still a ton of space to get better, and players can make dramatic jumps kind of, I think, still within that first 3,000 plate appearances in the big leagues. And I think, look, this is another – John Mailey has done a tremendous job here, and Pete's done a tremendous job of like, just getting to a place. I think Alex Bregman deserves a little bit of credit here. I mean, he was in Pete's ear from day one about this is something that he can get better at and he needs to get better at, and he had the ability to get better at. And it's also one of those things, like, you just – like Dansby, you just keep working, and maybe it doesn't click right away. And it didn't click at the start of the season, right? It wasn't there. It wasn't there for the first 6-7 weeks of the season. And then finally he found something that really clicked for him. And it's really just allowed him to make vastly improved ball strike swing decisions. And I think the other thing is that it also coincided with, like, as he started driving the baseball, I think pitchers started recognizing I should just throw the ball out of the strike zone, because normally he had swung at those pitches. He timed that up with the power and the plate discipline, and it's turned on into a really dangerous player. And the at bats that he's having right now, I mean, there was an at bat last homestand against Morahone, the left-handed reliever, mm-hmm. from the Padres, who's 100-mile-an-hour sinker ball or lefty, that's probably most left-handed hitters would say, tell you, the toughest at bat that they have. And Pete really just handled that at bat, where he almost created, he looked like he had the advantage in that at bat. And that's really hard to do. And that was an at bat to me that, and I know a bunch of people have talked about it, really stood out.
Yeah. And he's had a really good at bats against lefties really since mid-April, and then the production started to increase, and it's such a great success story, Craig, because it's like it doesn't happen in a vacuum. It's the hard work. It's Bregman, it's Justin Turner last year, it's Team USA, it's Schwarber, it's yourself, it's the coaches, and of course him, and I'll even include his upbringing, you know, knowing his folks a little bit. It's like all of it. And that's why I just love that storyline with him. He just wasn't satisfied with what happened last year. He has taken things to another level. So one last thing about him, and people have asked you, I'm sure, what's he like in the office with you? Because he does seem to be hard on himself, and he's got to let that go sometimes.
Yeah, I mean, I think, again, as a 24-year-old still learning himself and still learning the right thing to do, he makes mistakes, like more than most people, he lets people see his mistakes. yeah. And I think really that's why people love to watch him too. And like, you know, that's part of this. You're going to make mistakes. He doesn't necessarily internalize his mistakes. He needs to get it out to get past it. And we all see that. And I think we should, like, I'm not saying we should celebrate it, but I think we should empathize with that a little bit. And that's the way that he handles this. And, you know, he's got a lot on him. And if you want to be, you know, when you're blessed with this much talent and these many gifts, and you have this work ethic, like, some stuff's going to happen that you don't like, and you got to handle it. And I think that's just the way Pete processes it right now. He'll get better at it. Like, he's gotten better at making ball strike swing decisions. He'll get better at the other thing too. I promise you he will. But you know, I think we should give him some grace, and I've been pretty adamant about that. We should give him some grace for how this goes. As long as he's working on improving it.
Yeah. And I think Cub fans certainly are giving him grace, and you know, the opponent's a different story, or opposing fan bases, but they're not supposed to give him any. So that's the fun of this whole thing.
Inside the Friendly Confines with Jesse Rogers, presented by Arlington Toyota. Looking for a smart play on your next vehicle? Arlington Toyota delivers with a full lineup of dependable cars, SUVs, and trucks ready for Chicago drivers. The same trusted team you've known for years is now backed by new ownership from the Andy Moore Auto Group, bringing even more value every day. Visit ToyotaArlington.com today.
All right, we're about the fifth or sixth inning of this pod, Craig, and I want to talk to you about your least favorite subject, yourself. And I do appreciate you joining me, because I don't know if you've thought about this, but I've talked to other managers about it. It's the only profession maybe in the world where you have to speak publicly to reporters and fans once a day throughout 6 weeks of spring training and then twice a day throughout 162 games. So I can understand managers that don't want to continue to talk on podcasts and things. So I do appreciate it. And I do like the fact that you kind of understand our jobs. It's a daily sport. It's great for debate and things like that. So you help us in that manner. But I want to go back to just when you took the job in that first year. And what I'm getting at is, like, there's no grace for a manager. You can't, even as a free agent, you can maybe hide a little bit and ease yourself into a new play. You can't do that as the manager. So I wonder how long it took you to just kind of get comfortable with the added fact, of course, of coming from Milwaukee and Wisconsin so close by. It's not like you went from there to Tampa. Did it take some time, even though you're not allowed much time to get comfortable in that job?
Yeah, I mean, there's parts of the job that are comfortable immediately. I mean, honestly, the clubhouse is comfortable. For me, speaking to the media is comfortable. I've had years of practice at it. I think, you know, I still look back. The thing that was most uncomfortable was, frankly, just getting to know everybody. There was just the Cubs are a larger, you know, boat, so to speak. There's just more people, and there's a lot of people to get to know. There's a lot of, and that part for me was challenging, just making yourself feel like you're part of this and you know everybody and you have experience with everybody and you can have a conversation with everybody about what they're doing. That part took a little while. Working with, you know, the front office, I think it takes time. Look, it takes time. Like, you know, there's a way of doing things. You have a way of thinking about things. There's going to be some give and take from that and some back and forth and some understanding to how can we move together in the same direction. I think that took a little time, but I feel, you know, I think by the end of the first year, we were certainly there. You understand better how to move things to a better place.
I wonder if, just as we go back on the field a little bit, from the outside looking in, I feel like one of your big impacts had to do with dealing with Wrigley Field and using it to your advantage. I'm not saying you are the only one, but it feels like a new set of eyes in that dugout, even though you had played there and managed there, gave it some new perspective. And it feels like starting last year, you started to understand how to maybe utilize it to your advantage. And obviously you had that great win streak this year there. Do you feel like you understand Wrigley Field so much better than you did a couple years ago?
Yeah, I think, you know, and that you play a lot of games there as a visitor and probably, you know, 100 or so games, say, but on a daily basis, just you get just such a different appreciation for how unique the field plays and what it does to a game of baseball. Like, you know, when the wind blows in, you can basically, it's almost baseball without a home run. How would you play baseball if there was no such thing as a home run? You have to think about that some days. There's other days where you have to think about a pitcher can give up a 250-foot fly ball that turns into a home run. And that affects how you run a pitching staff that day. Incredibly, you have to be much more conservative because a pitcher could get stuck not by his own fault, just by pure bad luck. And then I think what things are you know, there is luck in baseball that we have to acknowledge. And so, what things that aren't on the luck side can we control? And that's the, you know, the defensive part of the game, the base running part of the game, when the wind is blowing in, that if we win the base running game that day, we should be able to create some bases that the other team can't. And that stuff is really important on days like that. And I think last year we really used that to our advantage. You know, and it's not, you're not always going to get that advantage. And I don't think we've gotten the same advantage this year. But I think last year we absolutely use that to our advantage. And it really, the wind was blowing in a lot more last year, and I think that's why we were able to use it to our advantage.
And of course, once in a while, it can work against you, you know, and help the other team. But that's part of it. One more on Wrigley, because you've spoken kind of romantically about it. And we've talked about the ivy this year. It looks a little thicker. It feels like there's been more action with the ivy. I mentioned this on my podcast the other day. When I was growing up a Cub fan, I thought every ballpark had ivy because I only knew Wrigley Field when I was 8, 9, 10. And then I didn't realize how unspecial the other parks were, if that's the right word. And it's still quite amazing after all these years. You have ivy, brick wall, incredible weather impacting the game more than any other park. Has it been fun to sort of feel it every day for almost three years now?
It still is, and it doesn't change that feeling. You know, we had an experience this past weekend with the fog. That was a one of a kind experience. And then the combination of just everything that is always there does make the place so special. And it's what creates the great joy in the park, I think, every single day. And that's what's the amazing part about the place, is that there's no other baseball stadium that creates the joy that Wrigley creates, in my opinion. And all of those things that you just mentioned are kind of what creates it outside the park, I think. Still, I mean, driving, I can take a lot of routes to the park, and I try to take different routes to the park to like see everything. But like, so the route down Sheffield is different than the route down Clark, you know what I mean? But it's important to soak all that in. And I love doing that on my way to the stadium every day.
You can be really hot in the sun, really cold in the shade. My first game, my dad bought me a sweatshirt. Expensive because we were in the shade. I had no idea it was going to be freezing. It's just it's quite the park. It really is. A little bit more about you. So in 2010, the Sporting News dubbed you the 13th smartest athlete in sports. You are one ahead of Peyton Manning. Now, this man is dissecting defenses. You're just throwing to the right base, but you were one ahead of Manning. And incidentally, Craig Breslow was number one on that list. And of course, he has a big time job. Chris Young was on that list. Brad Ausmus, who's a former manager. But I don't think it's smarts that makes necessarily a good manager. I think it's experience. And the one thing I wanted to ask you is your playing experience was just so extreme, incredible highs in the World Series and NLCS. And then you had journeyman grinder type moments. I mean, 0 for 45. I assume all that informs you when you are talking to players, especially ones that are struggling. They know you've been there. That we always hear that from players. It must give you a little bit of a leg up in understanding what a player is going through.
Yeah, I mean, it just does. I think it's not only like your personal experiences, but it's watching other players go through their journey. I mean, you know, like watching a young Prince Fielder come in Milwaukee, like start his major league career and kind of deal with everything he was dealing with, and have tremendous success. You know, there's some similarities. They're different to Pete there. You know what I mean? They're different type players, but there's some similarities there. So that helps you as a manager when you kind of remember players, that have gone through their journeys and what they stumbled on and what they had success with. You use that absolutely with your players. So that's the benefit. I mean, there's different skills to this job, and you have to use kind of your strengths. And one of my strengths is I did have a lot of experience. I've had a lot of experience in the dugout. You know, I've been at a major league dugout for a long time.
And you have a bit of a self-deprecating style. I mean, do you ever put your arm around a struggling player and remind him you went 0 for 45 and things like that?
I mean, we were on the mound the other night, and Dansby said, you hit just like Alec Burleson. And I said, man, Dansby, I wish I hit like Alec Burleson. Our hands may have been in the same place, but Alec Burleson is a way better hitter than I could have ever dreamed of being. So, yeah, I mean, I think I 0 for 45 will put a lot of things in perspective. and when you can, and a player comes to you and says, "Man, I'm really struggling," I said, "I got a story for you."
that works, and obviously has a guy that's never played the game has that disadvantage in a sense. Speaking of that, what's it like talking to you guys have had some streaky players, but baseball is streaky in general. Is your conversations, do you do anything different with a player struggling as opposed to when he's having success? I mean, we always talk about keeping things the same as much as you can, but do your conversations change?
Yeah, I think they do. I mean, I think, look, when players are struggling, you probably try to check in on them a little more. You know, when they're going well, you're probably just like, you're letting them alone and letting them do their thing, and they're in a good place, and they're, you know, they got to figure it out, so to speak. So I think you're probably trying to stay a little closer to them when they're struggling to make sure that, you know that you still believe and it's going to change, and making sure the work is still happening and that they believe in what they're doing. So, you know, I would say that's generally how it goes for me.
Before we get to our lightning round, which is just five quick questions for you, I want to ask you about being a dad of athletes, you know, Jack and Brady. Your daughter won a state title. Is it what we'd imagine? You're as nervous watching them in the stands as you could possibly be in the dugout as a manager?
Yeah, I mean, look, the reason I always say this is, like, the reason that youth sports is such a huge industry is because there's nothing better than watching your kids play sports, right?
That's right.
And that's why, you know, they preyed on watching your kids play sports and excel in sports, or just be part of a team. It's really fun, and it's really fun. So I love doing it. And I've had some great experiences doing it. And I also think sports is a great teacher for kids. It's a great teacher, and team sports are a great teacher for kids. So you hope there's kind of like that extra benefit from it, but it's a blast watching my daughter play in the state high school basketball tournament. I got to watch my son win a state championship in baseball, and now watching my daughter was certainly two of the biggest thrills I've had.
For sure. All right, lightning round. Now I'm going to give you some quick questions, but you can go as long as you want with your answers. Just jumping around a little bit. So let's just start with this: your favorite Jim Leland story. And there's a podcast, so you can go any direction you want, Craig.
Yeah, I mean, the best one was Mark Kotze, the athletics manager, and I always talk about this. We were in the Astrodome in Houston, and it was 1998, so the Marlins had traded, we'd won the World Series the year before, traded the core of the team, and was left with the young people and the young guys on the team. And we were playing poorly. Things were not going well. And he yelled at the team frequently. It happened a lot. And he got into one with us after a game we played that we didn't play well. And he would come yell at us for about a minute. And you don't even remember what he said. He'd yell at us for a minute, and then he'd leave. And then you'd kind of start, you know, getting undressed, maybe eating, getting a shower, and he'd come back, and he'd have taken some pieces of clothing off, and he'd yell some more, and then he'd leave. And now you're not sure, now should I do anything, or should I sit in my chair? Is he gonna come yell at us again? He'd come back again. This time he's almost naked, and he'd scream at you again about something, and you just never know when to get up out of your chair. And it was the classic. He was just getting stuff off his chest, you know, and at the end of it, everybody had left, and Mark and I were sitting there talking to each other, and he walks up to you and he says, "Man, I really scared the shit out of those guys today, didn't I?" And you're like, "Well, you scared the shit out of me too." So, you know,
the only thing that makes that better if he had a cigarette the whole time this was happening.
Yeah, he probably went in the office for it to take a couple drags off it.
Okay, so that reminds me, the only time, and I watched you in Milwaukee, the only time I've seen you yell or get upset publicly is in spring training this year during base running drills. And frankly, I wasn't quite sure if it was a little bit tongue in cheek and little serious or all serious or none serious. I immediately went on the radio and I said, I've never seen Craig this upset. Did I have it correct? Were you truly upset? And how many times have you really yelled at your team?
It was a little of both. I mean, I was upset. I was probably exaggerating what I was saying, but that's what you do when you're upset, you know?
Sure.
So it was a little of both for sure. That happened. I don't keep track of it. You know what I mean? It hits you. You know, that's what I say. It's got to be real. You got to be yourself in this job. And when stuff hits you, it hits you. It's happened. It's happened this year. But I really don't remember the times, to be honest with you.
Sure. Okay. Got it. Okay. Let's move on. Quick ones. Does your wife ever critique your work, a decision, whatever the case may be?
Very little. No, she does not. No. 30 years in baseball, it's like, you know, the game is the game, right?
Mm-hmm. I thought you might say, well, she's enough to criticize outside the game, like my wife does.
So. Yeah, that's the right answer. You're right.
All right. Who is sneaky funny on the bus or plane?
Probably like on the coach's bus, sir, I would say Danny Mueller, the clubhouse manager.
The equipment manager is
definitely the winner there. He is quick, great sense of humor, and he can quickly bring somebody down.
Yeah,
he can take you down fast.
And he's been there a long time, so he has some credentials to go with that. Yeah, two more. And this might be a little bit more nuanced. What do you think the current biggest misconception is among fans and even media about Major League Baseball right now? What do we get wrong enough? Because God knows we do.
Oh,
some
wow.
Come to mind? I know.
Yeah, I don't. I mean, I think the thing that I probably admire most now, like, I guess the thing that I admire is about players right now is that the daily grind. Like, I don't know if I realized how hard it is to play every day and to and then in this era of the media coverage different and the social part of it and the stuff on your phone, like, I really respect the ability to perform every day and to get up every day for performance. And to do it 162 days games, you know, I have tremendous respect for that. And I think people that cover the game every day have the same respect, but I think it's hard as a fan to like understand that this happens every single day. And you have to perform every single, you're expected to perform every day.
Absolutely. All right. Last one. What do you think we were talking about Wrigley Field earlier. What do you think your career batting average was at Wrigley Field? Want to take a guess?
I don't think I did anything special there. So 230.
235. Very, very on cue there. So my final question is, what former Cub was toughest on you? Which pitcher was toughest, whether it be Wrigley or in your home park? Who got you? Not even, I don't even have the numbers in front of me. I'm just curious what you thought.
Yeah, I mean, I remember facing two Cubs. Like, Kerry Wood was always, like, fun to face because his breaking ball was just like, man, how am I going to hit this? How am I going to hit this breaking ball today? Like, it was an incredible pitch. And then I also, for some reason, I remember Ryan Dempster too, because we're friends, and you know, he had that goof, you know, he had that big glove wiggle to try to hide the split finger, and I had trouble with the split finger a little bit. So I remember at bats against him, I didn't do anything against him, but I remember I did hit one homer off him, I'm pretty sure, but I didn't do much else. But I remember Ryan Dempster at bats as well.
Craig, thank you so much for this. You know, just days away from a little bit of a break for you and the team. I don't know anybody in baseball that doesn't say I could use this all-star break to refresh a little bit. So thank you. And we'll see you back at Wrigley Field next week.
All right, Jesse, take care. Have a great week.